Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 218th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the most likable and reliably good actors in the business, and he has been for nearly 40 years. In the 1980s, he was a child star whose face was plastered on the bedroom walls of young girls across America. Then, after largely fading from the scene in the 1990s, he reemerged in the first decade of the 2000s as an adult, and specifically as the industry's go-to straight man, winning acclaim for his work on screens big and small, starting with his portrayal of Michael Bluth, the only sane member of a big family of nutjobs, on Arrested Development, which aired on Fox for three seasons, spanning 2003 through 2006, and was awarded the Best Comedy Series Emmy in 2004. And for which he took home the Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy Series Golden Globe in 2005. Now, in 2018, he is poised to land Best Actor Emmy nominations for two different shows, both of which hail from Netflix. One is the rookie drama series Ozark, which he also executive produced, and four of the 10 episodes of which he also directed. And he already has received Best Actor Golden Globe and SAG Award nominations for his work on that show. The second is the aforementioned Arrested Development, which was revived at Netflix in 2013 and returns to the streaming service on May 29th. He has previously received a total of two Emmy, two SAG, and two Golden Globe nominations for his work on that show, including the one that I already mentioned resulted in a Golden Globe win. Over the course of our conversation, Bateman and I discuss all of the above, plus much more. But first, I was joined at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter by Booth Moore, THR's style and fashion news director. Everybody seems to be talking about style and fashion these days in connection with May 7th's Met Gala, the ongoing Cannes Film Festival, Saturday's Royal Wedding, and the list goes on. This is not an area that I can claim to know that much about, so it's a treat to be able to bring in someone who can. Booth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, let's touch on each of these big three events that I just mentioned, if we can. Let's start with the Met Gala. I enjoyed Andrew Rossi's doc on that a few years ago called The First Monday in May, which sort of shows just how much work goes into this each year. It's a fundraiser for the Costume Institute in New York City. It's chaired by Vogue editor Anna Wintour. It always has a theme. What was this year's theme?
It was Heavenly Bodies, which is pegged to their big exhibition, which is a showcase for how Catholicism has affected fashion. So the dress code was actually Sunday Best, which was kind of fun. And there were like a bazillion different interpretations. And what I really love about the event is it's really sort of like the perfect combination of couture and costume party, you know? I think everyone, you know, there's a million touch points that you can kind of be drawn into it.
The thing that I've never fully understood about this is some people wear things that look like something that your average Joe would aspire to wear to something nice. Other people show up, as Sarah Jessica Parker did this year, with the nativity scene on her head. How do you find the balance between adhering to the theme and actually wearing something that is practical?
I think this is the place where you can really throw practicality out of the window. I mean, this is the event that has stars arriving, you know, in their own vans because they can't they literally can't sit down in their gowns. Right. So I think it's kind of it's the opportunity to go completely over the top, but also to kind of make a political statement, you know, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And that's something I think we've been seeing more and more on the red carpets everywhere. And certainly it happened at the Met Gala. If you look at Rihanna dressing as a female pope. I mean, obviously, in the Catholic Church, we would never see a female pope. Right. So that was quite a statement. And Lena Waithe wearing a rainbow flag. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's ways that you can kind of, even Amal Clooney's outfit was a bit of a statement. So.
And that actually pissed off Tom Ford, right? Because what was the story there? She was supposed to wear Tom Ford and then she showed up in something else?
She was supposed to wear Tom Ford. He had made a gown for her that was, I guess, evocative of stained glass. And to his surprise, if the story is to be believed, instead she came out in this sort of metallic tinfoily bustier over pants that was actually by a British designer named Richard Quinn. And then she changed into his dress inside in the gift shop. And I guess he wasn't too pleased about that. But, you know, I mean, interestingly, I think the point maybe that she was trying to make was to support this young designer, Richard Quinn, mm-hmm. who, you know, British fashion has been somewhat challenged recently because of Brexit and the fallout of that. And here's a guy who literally was in his second season and he had the Queen attend his show. It was the first fashion show that she'd ever been to in February. And
how did he get her to show up?
Well, she gave an award to him. It was the first fashion award in her name. Wow. And so he received it. She came to the show to give it to him. And Amal Clooney decided to wear his design on sort of the biggest red carpet on the international fashion stage, I guess, aside from Cannes.
Yeah. Well, and we'll come to that in a second. But just a follow up about bouncing off of Amal Clooney here. So she was an honorary event day chair this year. That's sort of along with Rihanna and Donatella Versace. So she was going to be there no matter who she was wearing. But how does it work? You're invited as an individual, or you're invited by a fashion house that buys a table there, or how? Because a lot of money is spent on this thing.
Yeah, the tables cost about $750,000. And so design houses take them and then they invite all the guests to sit with them. But the thing is that Anna Wintour approves every outfit. It is involved in choosing it. So
every outfit that even if it's so a designer buys a table for $750,000 and presumably to then dress their table guests in their outfit,
right.
But that still has to be approved by Anna Wintour?
That's still, Vogue is still involved in, yeah, in dressing absolutely everyone. So it's a Vogue show, but Anna went on to Stephen Colbert and said that she was surprised that Amal changed in the gift shop. So maybe Amal did take matters into her own hands as far as deciding what she was going to wear out front. Who knows?
So whose outfit, maybe a male and a female, most impressed you at this year's Met Gala?
I mean, I already said I thought Rihanna was like, I loved that sort of thumb in the eye mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. that outfit. But, you know, there were lots of incredible Versace creations that sort of ran the gamut from a Joan of Arc look that I believe was worn by... Was that worn by Zendaya? To something that was an elaborate ball gown that Blake Lively wore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was kind of an incredible display of the range of the House of Versace. You had angel wings on Katy Perry. There was like just nutty stuff as well. But, you know, that's what made it fun to look at and to write about. And I think everyone kind of could somehow, you know, had the theme would register with them in some way because this was about what you're reverent about and something that looks holy. As far as the men go, you know, Chadwick Boseman looked amazing. I've really liked his style lately. I think he, you know, kind of was rocking this sort of Elvis type mm-hmm. look that was like half religious, half king of pop. And, you know, even Donald Glover, I think, has been stepping up his game and I loved his lavender velvet suit and white loafers.
So will we ever see any of these outfits again, or where do they go? Do they go to the Costume Institute, or do they go back to the designer? I can't imagine somebody just showing up at another event wearing wings or whatever they, you know, people wore to this.
No, that's actually a great point. You could have a whole exhibition of just what people have worn to the Met Gala.
They should, right? I mean, maybe that should be part of the term.
Exactly.
If you want to come, you got to let us borrow it.
Yes, usually on red carpet looks go back to the designers, even in the case of celebrities, an Oscars red carpet and all that. So usually they go back into the designer's archives.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's talk about Cannes. This is still going on in the south of France. The most famous film festival in the world spans 11 days. Most people who are there cycle in and out in just a handful of days, but the jurors are there from beginning to end. And this year, there were quite a few female jurors, including the jury chair, Cate Blanchett, Ava DuVernay, and Kristen Stewart. It's been the year of women there. They've pointed out, I think, there were 82 females who stood on the steps leading up to the Palais to, in a way, symbolically note that only 82 women have had films that they directed at Cannes over its history. But it's a fact of life, I think, that fashion at Cannes demands more of women than men, since men are basically just tuxing it up every night. But these women, particularly the jurors, they must have to show up with boatloads of outfits because they have a different look every night. What must it be like for somebody like Cate Blanchett, who's got a, you know, sort of is expected to show up every night looking good?
Yeah, I mean, for if you're lucky, like Cate, I spoke to her stylist, Elizabeth Stewart, who actually is there with her. So she is keeping track of all the different looks and everything that goes with them or whatever. But sometimes Elizabeth has sent stars on their own and, you know, you just have to have everything in clear wardrobe bags. And, you know, she does PDFs of every outfit that she gives to female stars so they can keep track of what to wear when and what goes with it. But yeah, it really is. It's a lot to keep track of. And I think Elizabeth said that they were working on somewhere between 20 and 30 looks for Cate. So, and there is, you know, there is a little bit of disparity on how much the women have to deal with looking completely different to everything they go to and the men. I mean, they could easily wear the same tuxedo and who would notice? Right,
right. Well, and I actually thought it was very refreshing that Cate Blanchett said something, maybe it was even the opening night of Cannes, that she rewore a dress that she had worn to a previous event, a high-profile event, and she basically said what I think a lot of people think out in the real world, which is that, you know, when you've got such a beautiful outfit, it's ridiculous to never wear it again because you've worn it once years ago. What was the story there? Because that's actually very unusual, right?
Yeah, it is. When I spoke to Elizabeth, she said that they were really, that she and Cate really thought about her wardrobe and wanted it to be reflective of current topics that people are talking about, not only in fashion, but in Hollywood. So they wanted to put a focus on female designers. They wanted to put a focus on sustainability. And in the name of sustainability, they decided to have her rewear this Giorgio Armani dress that she had worn to the SAG Awards in 2014. And it's an absolutely beautiful black lace gown. And yeah, I mean, it looked as great now as it did then. And I guess it was to prove the point that if you do have something beautiful, why not rewear it? She's also been wearing a lot of Chopard jewelry, and Chopard has some dedication to sustainability with the fair mining and things like that.
Interesting. Well, Ken is very strict about a lot of things this year. They've implemented a no selfie ban on their red carpet. They also, for, you know, as far back as they've existed, I think, have required men to be black tie on the red carpet. The only person who was ever the exception to that rule was Pierre Ressant, this film insider who actually just died within the last month. He could show up in a sweater or whatever, and they didn't give him a hard time, from what I understand. But women, the latest restriction that they've had to deal with at Cannes is that they are not supposed to wear flats on the red carpet. This rule was sort of disregarded, I guess, for the first time in 2016 by Julia Roberts. There's a kind of now iconic photo of her with her heels in her hand going up to Thierry Frémaux, the guy who runs it, on the red carpet. And because she's Julia Roberts, I don't think they're going to screw with her. It's not like, sorry, you can't come in. And actually this year, this happened again with Kristen Stewart. Was this just because she actually was uncomfortable, or do you think there was a point trying to be made here about this treatment of women?
I'm sure the heels looked like they may have been uncomfortable, but I think she was trying to make a point too. And, you know, it's, again, to your question about female jurors, I mean, being there for 20 days and wearing heels for 20 days straight to events, I mean, that is like torture. So, you know, I think this rule is absolutely crazy, and that women are right to protest it. And I think it was, you know, it was definitely a popular video to see her taking off her shoes and just sort of walking right up there in bare feet, and that they should maybe sort of stop trying to legislate right. What people wear and or legislate taste, as Elizabeth Stewart puts it.
Yes.
I interviewed her.
No, it's I feel like that rule will not last much long. I can't last for much longer in the current climate. But well, so again, I guess let's talk about the big winner or loser out of Cannes. I will just say I'm not all that cognizant about these things, but I certainly did notice Kendall Jenner's outfit this year. I don't even know why she was at the festival, but she certainly stood out. So if you want to say anything about that.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, she was maybe trying to make a bit of a point, too. You know, you could say free the nipple, perhaps, was her point. She has worn a couple of practically completely sheer outfits on the red carpets there. And, you know, I think Cannes really also a playground for models. It, you know, it has been certainly traditionally over the years. And so it's not that surprising to see her there. Certainly there are a lot of fashion brands there doing business and having parties and so on. So, you know, not surprising that she would sort of be representing her brand there as well. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, she just kind of said, hey, who's going to mess with me? I can step out and do this. And you know, she actually looked quite beautiful in both dresses. And again, you think, you know, this is the south of France where women go topless on the beach, right?
It's synonymous with Cannes.
Exactly. So what's the problem?
Right. All right. Royal wedding time. Harry and Meghan, Saturday. Is dad coming or isn't he? Doesn't look like it. Is Meghan actually going to become a princess? No, she's a duchess, but who's counting? Do I care about any of this? No, but a lot of other people do. So I guess all of that is to ask you, what should those people who do give a damn about any of this be looking for in terms of fashion at this event? Who might be the Pippa Middleton of this cycle? Somebody, you know, that surprises us and steals the scene from the stars? What will you be looking for? I know that's a lot of questions, but basically give us a preview of what's coming on Saturday.
Well, it's actually a really interesting story for Hollywood because, you know, here's this Hollywood starlet who's, you know, marrying into the royal family. So we're going to be looking to see how she represents herself and her own personality and what she chooses to wear. She's an American. She's biracial. You know, will any of her choices reflect that? Mm-hmm. I mean, people, you know, they like to take bets on everything and people are betting on who will design her gown. And right now, I think the forerunner is Ralph and Russo, which is a couture house that's actually relatively young, that's based in London, formed in 2007, and has a female designer who is notable because she was the first person, the first Brit in 100 years to be invited to show during Paris Couture. So she's dressed a ton of celebrities, including Angelina Jolie, Lupita Nyong'o, etc. And she's really the forerunner right now to do the gown. But, you know, she could also go with Burberry. Christopher Bailey, who's the outgoing designer there, just showed his last collection was very pointedly a message about LGBTQ. And so she, you know, Meghan Markle is also interested in supporting those rights and could go with him. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, whoever she chooses, there will be sort of some sort of message in it. And she's expected to go with someone who's British in some way, because again, it's a big booster to the British fashion industry.
Right.
And then I think we'll also be looking for any nods to Princess Diana. Uh-huh. You know, certainly the engagement ring was a nod to her because there's this enormous diamond from Botswana, but then there's also diamond that, you know, belonged to Princess Diana. So, you know, there could be a nod to her American heritage in something that she wears. People will be looking at what tiara she wears.
Right.
So, I mean, absolutely every little detail will be dissected. And, you know, I think they've already made some interesting choices about their ceremony with, you know, who the preacher that they're having, who's American, and Elton John. And, you know, so I think it'll be interesting to watch. As far as who will be the Pippa Middleton, she doesn't have a maid of honor. So there won't be a literal Pippa Middleton, but certainly some sort of pop culture star will emerge from this.
Inevitably.
I'm just
sorry we won't get to see what dad would have worn, but.
I know. I feel like he will hopefully be tweeting or something from.
Or auctioning off tweets.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. So on a more serious note, I want to talk about Georgina Chapman. This is the wife of Harvey Weinstein and the mother of two young children that she had with him, as well as the co-founder with Karen Craig of the high-end women's wear brand Marquesa. She is the subject of a new profile in Vogue, which was written by Jonathan Van Meter and features photographs by none other than Annie Leibovitz. And it is causing, for lack of a better phrase, all sorts of shit, I guess, because the article and she in it suggests that she was quote unquote naive and had no idea that Harvey was doing the sorts of things that he was doing. I do personally think it's ridiculous to blame a wife for a husband's behavior, but this gets tricky because of the perception, at least, that Harvey is the hidden hand behind Marquesa. And so people are now having their knives out for Marquesa, which was established in 2004, the same year that Georgina Chapman met Harvey Weinstein. Would Marquesa be the massive and really, from my understanding, very significant brand that it is without Harvey Weinstein?
I doubt that it would without his Hollywood connections. But I echo what you say, and that, you know, you can't really blame a wife for a husband's actions. I think that it is pretty well documented that he was involved in getting, you know, actresses he was working with to wear the brand. I mean, I've talked to people who worked at Miramax in New York back in the day and talked about sort of dresses being shuttled around the city and, you know, him really wanting to know, keep tabs on who was wearing what and when it was going to happen and this kind of a thing. So, but I think there's a leap to then how that is involved with any alleged, you know, sexual harassment or sexual abuse. I think his sort of strong arm tactics in the industry were fairly well known, you know, both sort of in the entertainment side of things and in fashion. But again, that's not necessarily related to these alleged crimes that we're talking
about. And it sounds like, and you know, I'll ask you because you know, but it sounds like from the Vogue article that whether or not he was there, you know, was driving the establishment of Marquesa, it actually did grow to become a brand that can stand on its own and is worthy of being worn to major events on red carpets. But if Harvey Weinstein and Georgina Chapman's relationship is severed, not just romantically, but also professionally, is there any reason why Marquesa wouldn't continue to deserve to be in the elite tier of brands?
I don't think so. I mean, the brand was a little bit on the wane before the Harvey allegations came out, before the scandal broke. At its height, they would have sometimes 6 to 8 people wearing it on Golden Globes night or Academy Awards night. And it had really sort of dwindled down to maybe one person. Mm-hmm. But certainly there are lots of licensed brands that they also have, a lower price brand. They had a jewelry collaboration, accessories, those kinds of things. So the brand did grow beyond its presence on the red carpet, and also the whole bridal business, which, you know, I've talked to people who own bridal salons, and they say that sales have not dropped off at all. You know, and I think there's a disconnect within a lot of customers' minds. They don't even really know that the brand Marquesa, the word Marquesa, is associated with Harvey Weinstein.
It's probably so nice that she's probably very thankful today that she didn't change her name to Georgina Weinstein.
Exactly. So, you know, but it was an interesting sort of orchestrated campaign by Vogue to get this brand back on track, sort of having the profile come out, coupled with Scarlett Johansson wearing the brand, being the first A-lister to do so on the red carpet at the Met Gala.
I want to ask you about that because, yeah. I mean, to me, I again, with very limited knowledge of fashion, it just actually, my references often come from the movies. And all I could think about when I saw that Scarlett Johansson had done this, really the first person to wear it at a prominent event since the Harvey stuff came out. I mean, it was missing entirely from the Oscars this year because people just didn't know why court controversy. But it was a pretty bold thing for Scarlett to wear that. And I'm thinking, it brings me back to Jezebel, where Bette Davis shows up in that, even though it's black and white, we know it's a red dress at an event where you're only supposed to wear white if you're an unmarried woman. So anyway, it felt like that kind of a statement for Scarlett Johansson, who's can wear anybody she wants, to wear Marquesa. Do you have any reason to believe that it was intended as a statement, or she just liked the dress?
No, I'm sure it was intended as a statement, and it was probably part of the deal to get the profile in Vogue to have an A-lister wear it at the Met Gala. I think also, yeah, there was lots of symbolism in that dress. You know, her name is Scarlett Johansson, yeah. Scarlet Letter. You know, the dress was tinged red, you know. I think, and the theme was religion and sort of thinking about redemption and that kind of thing. I think it was a very pointed statement. But, you know, even just in the few days after that, people are sort of still reticent to talk about it. I mean, stylists don't want to be quoted about Marquesa. There's still this attitude in Hollywood, I think, that people are just kind of waiting to see because they don't want their words or attentions to be twisted. And, you know, they don't want to somehow seem like they're not supporting Time's Up or they're not supporting women who are coming forward about sexual abuse allegations. So it's still a very loaded topic.
I guess what it may come down to is just how much Georgina Chapman herself is willing to totally throw Harvey overboard at the moment. In this article itself, she acknowledges they're still in touch, which is understandable. They have children together and, you know, they're, I guess, probably working on a divorce. But unless and until there's a total severance there, it may remain in purgatory. And that's tough when you have 80 people working for you, as she apparently does. But it will be interesting to follow. And thank you for humoring a dilettante on this subject today, Booth Moore. I appreciate
it. Anytime. Thank you.
And now for my interview with Jason Bateman. Over the course of our conversation at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter, the 49-year-old and I discussed a wide range of topics, among them how Bateman began acting professionally at the age of just 10, wound up doing so rather quickly on major shows like Little House on the Prairie and Silver Spoons, and came to feel about how his work impacted his relationships with family and friends, what led to him directing for the first time at the age of just 18, making him the youngest person in the history of the Directors Guild of America to receive a directing credit, and planting the seeds for his desire to return to directing years later, why he largely disappeared from the public's consciousness once he hit his 20s, and the sometimes problematic ways in which he handled that dry period in his career, how his career came back from the dead, in a sense, thanks to Arrested Development, and how he came to accept and embrace his new identity as a straight man in comedies of all sorts, why he is particularly proud of Ozark, every element of which has his fingerprints all over it, from its look to its tone to the fact that his character, a middle-class financial advisor who gets into trouble with a Mexican drug cartel for which he agreed to launder money, appears in virtually every scene of the show, plus much more. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Jason, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We always begin the same way. Just where were you born and raised? What did your folks do for a living?
I thought it would be a quick prayer. No. I was born in Rye, New York, and I lived there till I was 2. I lived in Boston till I was 4. Lived in Salt Lake City till I was 7, and then have been living in LA ever since. Mm-hmm. I'm now 49. My parents are both still living. Mm-hmm. Dad was an independent writer, director, producer, mm-hmm. and post-production sort of dude. Mm-hmm. My mom was a stewardess/flight attendant, mm-hmm. I think it was later to be termed, for Pan Am for almost 30 years.
Mm-hmm. I was reading about her. It sounds like she was, you know, had to be, just by the nature of the work, out of the home half the time, right?
About every 2 weeks she was gone for a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And my dad, doing that independent thing, often had him either out of town or on set, mm-hmm. or down in the basement, you know, writing some spec script. So Justine and I, we had to sort of let ourselves in and cook ourselves dinner often, not in a, I don't want to paint a picture of neglect, but we were given a large amount of responsibility early on. And I think it served me in that I wasn't overwhelmed with a lot of the accelerated responsibility and work, you know, when I was a little kid. I think it gave me a little head start.
Yeah. And we should note, for anyone who doesn't know, Justine is your sister, older by 2 years?
3 years.
3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And she preceded you into the business?
It seemed like she did, because that Family Ties was so incredibly successful. But in reality, I'd started doing commercials for a year or two, and then I was on Little House on the Prairie for a year, and I think I was through Silver Spoons by the time she decided that in order to help her pay for hotel rooms in New York as a model, she was going back and forth with my mom or my dad, whoever was free, to do modeling work. She thought, well, that commercial money looks pretty good. And so she went into acting about 3 years afterwards, I think, mm-hmm. and did 2 quick commercials. I think it was Wheaties and Dial Soap. And then I think her third audition was Family Ties. And off she went.
Yeah. I believe that you started at the age of 10. And I just wonder what brought that about. And also, you know, as you look back at it, how does that happen? Is it your decision? Is it somebody encouraging you to do it? What's the beginning for you?
Yeah, I think in traditional households, you know, the dad takes the son out to the park and throws the ball, and then that kid, you know, throws the ball pretty good, and he thinks, well, I'm going to be a baseball player or a football player, and then away they go. In my case, my dad took me to, like, these, you know, foreign film kind of art houses, and like New Art, you know, down here on Santa Monica, and, you know, I'd see these cool foreign films, or I didn't know they were cool yet. I was kind of pissed off. I had to read all the dialogue because they were all subtitled. But that the seed was planted to you know, he'd show me what good acting is, what bad acting is, what good directing is, what bad directing, what is directing. And so we had a neighbor that was my dad's age, and he was an actor, and he, on his way to an audition one day, saw me out in the driveway washing the car with my dad, and he said, hey, Jason, you want to come with me and see how an audition goes? And so the seed of interest had already been planted through my dad, and I said, sure. So I went with this guy, and they were reading for the role of the son the same day. And he put these sides in my hand, you know, this little piece of, you know, of the script, of some dialogue that actors use to audition with. And he said, just go in there and make it look like you know what you're doing, that you were supposed to be here, that they made some sort of mistake, you know, that you're not on the list. So I went in there and read for it and got this part. And so I went home and told my dad, you know, hey, I think I'm good at this. Let's take some pictures of me and see if I can get an agent. And so that's kind of the way it started, just sort of harmlessly and kind of as a hobby. And you know, getting out from school earlier to go to auditions and stuff like that was a lot of fun. That's mm-hmm. kind of the way I saw it. And I was a bit of a jackass when I was a kid and liked being able to go and shill for, you know, cereals and be some sort of a smartass in TV shows and stuff like that. And I didn't really see it much as a career until, you know, I started to become 15, 16.
And prior to that, was there, because you were getting, I guess, your first role that you mentioned with Little House on the Prairie as an orphan who is brought into the Ingall family.
Yeah.
But when you're even now, so that's you're on TV now, had you ever been subjected to an acting class or anything, or was just sort of natural stuff?
Yeah, it was just, I was just naturally full of shit as a kid. I could really sort of pretend to be somebody else and have no sort of remorse about fooling somebody. Yeah, it was something that it just was just very comfortable for me and remains comfortable, knock wood, and has consequently allowed me to observe other parts of the process such that, you know, I became interested in directing and dealing with other departments.
With Little House on the Prairie, that group of actors I know had been together for a while, probably for some of them back to Bonanza, right?
Yeah, for sure.
How important, you know, do you think it was in terms of making you want to remain a part of this stuff to have the environment that you had with that? And I know I read that Michael Landon was somebody that was, you know, you looked up to. Just what was that first big experience that probably set the tone for how you felt going forward, right?
It did. Yeah, it was hugely important, and it did shape my perspective of a set and what it could be, what it should be. The fact that you can get a full call sheet shot without yelling, and you can be kind and supportive and encouraging to not only the actors, or, you know, even if they're little kids especially, and but also to crew members, and that familial dynamic was ever present there, because as you said, a lot of the cast and certainly a lot of the crew had been together for all of those years during Bonanza, and there was just a groove they were all in, and I could have been exposed to a completely different and in fact more typical environment, and that would have shaped the guy I sort of became. And when I was in you know, privileged to be in a position of leadership, you know, what kind of leader would I be? What was my example? And Michael Landon was, you know, if memory serves, I mean, certainly if you go into a time machine and look at the way you saw things when you were 10, 11 years old, it might not hold up. But as far as I remember, that guy was, he was sort of the George Clooney of the day, and that crews loved him and cast loved him. And there was an ease and a comfort with what he was doing such that he was able to be a sense of energy and encouragement, positivity, you know, around the set. It was fun, irrespective of the fact you were doing dramatic work.
I guess it was about 2 years you were on that, and then pretty much it seems like right into the next thing. How did you go right into Silver Spoons, where people of that day will very clearly remember Ricky Schroeder's best friend, sort of the bad boy. I think at that point, is that what made you the, along with Charlie Sheen and Corey Haim and some of these guys, you're the guy on the posters of a lot of walls. Was that directly kind of as a result of that show, or when did that start to happen?
You're talking about like that Teen Idol stuff?
Yeah, when did that begin?
I was never at the Corey Haim, Charlie Sheen, Scott Baio, you know, the rest of them, even Ricky Schroeder. I mean, I was deep into the magazine. I don't think I was ever on the covers. I'm sure I wouldn't have minded, but those dudes were hotter. Let's be clear.
Well, you're still here.
I felt and was told, maybe I've got the order wrong, that any kid that's on television at that age is going to be in those magazines. So I never really took it personally and sort of the junk food positive encouragement that one might. I just saw it as kind of a cool, quirky fringe benefit, but I didn't see as like, yeah, damn right, I'm it. Although I will admit, I thought I was pretty badass at that age. I think most kids do. I mean, I see some old tape of me on a talk show or whatever it is, and I'll just always just be just repulsed by how fearless and cocky and confident I was back then. I guess every kid is, you know, you think it's all going to be unicorns and rainbows your whole life.
Well, but for a while though it was, because wasn't it right after that, now you get your first show of your own? This is NBC, it's your move. It didn't last for all that long, but that was the first time you're the man on a show.
Yeah, and again, you're still kind of in a bubble. I mean, I'm living at home. You know, I'm 14 years old, and my mom and dad are my manager, which, you know, is probably another podcast we could do about that. But I'm still just that just felt like a natural offshoot of Silver Spoons. That character on Silver Spoons was kind of a character that you love to hate. It was really well written by that writing staff, and it kind of created its own kind of group of followers and fans, and while it wasn't a spinoff, they did create a character that still had, you know, some swagger to him and some mischief, and that's what It's Your Move was. And yeah, as you said, it didn't even last a full season, but it did sort of put me firmly on the radar at NBC, and that went into Valerie.
And Valerie, why did that have so many different names? At one point it's Valerie, then I guess when she left it's something else. And
yeah, it was Valerie until Valerie Harper left the show, and then when she left the show it briefly became known as Valerie's Family, because Sandy Duncan came in as our aunt, right? The father's sister. And then it became the Hogan Family, and then became the Hogans. Oh, and it switched networks too. It went to CBS at the end. That probably precipitated the final name change, I'm guessing, though.
So how does it happen that at just 18, I think younger than anyone else in the history of the DGA, you wind up directing three episodes of, I think at this point it was the Hogan Family, but like this really goes back that far to the age of 18, your interest in, or it sounds like even before that, the interest, but this was when you first directed on TV?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I was speaking to Bob Boyette, one of the executive producers, about having someone direct an episode, whether it be a crew member or something, I forget. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not uncommon for producers to talk to the cast about who they're comfortable with and who should we have back and who should we bring on. And it was during the course of one of those conversations where he said, you know, do you think you might want to direct one? And I was like, yeah, sure, that sounds cool. And so, yeah, we were working. I remember one day we were rehearsing, you know, middle of the week, and the stage phone rang, and someone answered it, and they said, Jason, it's the DGA for you. They want to talk to you. So I picked up the phone, and they said, we want to let you know that, I don't know if you know this or not, but you're the youngest director ever, that you'd beat Malcolm Jamal Warner by a couple of months and Spielberg by like 3 months.
That's
or whatever the
crazy,
hell it was.
Huh?
I don't know, but it was, I just remember those two names and thinking, wow, that's
pretty cool.
That was pretty cool. I don't know if it still stands, but it was an intimidating phone call to get for sure.
And were you just, in terms of the actual process, you were hooked, or was that the root of what today lives on through Ozark and everything, that you really wanted to keep doing that?
I do remember that the most exciting and gratifying part of it was staying late with one of our best and favorite director, Rich Carrell, stayed with me on the stage till like midnight, the night before camera blocking day, which is typically on a Thursday for a Friday show. So he stayed at the stage with me till like midnight the Wednesday night and helped me block camera block my script, which is basically, in those days, it was just three cameras. And so you've got A camera, B camera, and C camera moving left to right across the stage. And you basically decide on what line each one of those cameras is going to point to a different character so that when that character starts talking, the camera's already pointed at them. So it's just a choreography of things. And oftentimes a director will take longer with that camera blocking day, that day being Thursday, to give all the cameramen and the dolly grips their notes about what the choreography and order of all those assignments are. They'll take longer doing that than the cameraman and the dolly grip and the camera coordinator need, you know, because they do it every week. And as an actor, or certainly somebody that was as interested as I was into, you know, absorbing the rest of the process, I just always would see kind of their frustration, like, boy, if they could do it on their own, we'd be out of here by lunch. And so that was my goal, was to really come to work that next day prepared enough to really give everybody a short day, because it's really just a technical day. And we did get out by lunch for the first time ever that next day. And I just remember the attaboys that I got from, you know, these seasoned technicians, these cameramen and dolly grips and focus pullers and the camera coordinator, really looking at me like, you know, wow, you really did your homework and you did good, kid. Yeah. Like, that was something that I'll just never forget. And it did fuel a lot of the further observations that I would make to different departments of what they were doing every single day. And certainly as I went into single camera work, it becomes a little bit more diverse, a little bit more complicated than the filming of a situation comedy where you're dealing with just a proscenium. You know, a single camera, obviously you're moving beyond that line, and it just becomes different. So,
but as with Ozark, you're also at that point directing yourself, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that part was and continues to be, fortunately, a really comfortable and efficient thing for me, because it is one less actor that I need to direct. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, for better or for worse, that actor, that guy is reading my mind on every take. He's making just a very subtle adjustment to facilitate that camera move. Like, he's holding his line a little bit longer, waiting for that dolly to finish its move across the track. Or he's no longer shadowing that actor when they enter that room because he just noticed that there was a shadow there, so he's putting his weight on his upstage foot or whatever. Like, these are notes you might forget to give to an actor, but I, having a great seat to watch this process by being in the scene, I'm remembering all these things that I would like to change in the next take, and I can just immediately move on to talking to you about how I'd like for you to think about maybe doing a little bit something different on that line. Or so it's, I really enjoy it. It gives me two hands on the wheel to affect a much more specific and sometimes narrower target tonally, if I'm the person you're looking at and listening to, as well as the person that's making a lot of the decisions behind the camera.
Interesting. Yeah. So you started now for the first time getting into directing at 18. That's, you know, the end of what most people regard as childhood. When you look back at that whole childhood career that started, you know, 8 years earlier and would continue beyond that, I think you said your dad was your manager until you were 20. Mm-hmm. How do you regard it? Was it, do you look back and say this was a happy, fun time, or it was a stressful time? That's speaking professionally, but personally, did it complicate things to basically be represented by a family member? And at least according to one account that I had come across, essentially supporting the family along with your sister. Yeah. Like, does that put stress on a kid?
Yeah, it does. And maybe saying supporting was overstating it. I mean, certainly my mother and father were making money for sure. But obviously when you compare it against, you know, pulling a percentage of what a network rate would be to, you know, two people that are on network television series, you know, that's all of those incomes combined afforded us a different way to live. Mm-hmm. And were Justine and I to stop working, there would have been an uncomfortable adjustment. Mm-hmm. So supporting would be to overstate it. My parents worked their nards off for, you know, their whole lives. It was complicated, but also beneficial. And, you know, I can go down the list of the pros and the cons of it. Generally speaking, the cons were the added reality of if you don't maintain a C grade average, your work permit will not be renewed and therefore you will not be on the show and therefore you will have to make that financial adjustment to your living situation. So that was sort of real easy math. So when you take midterms and finals and there's such a huge effect over your grade and this work permit's getting renewed every 6 months, it's, you know, if I fail that test, it's not just a slap on the wrist from a teacher. It's people out of work and us having to move. So that wasn't lost on me. But as I said earlier, the added responsibility and deference paid to me as a young kid by adults really kind of filled my bucket, you know, and made me feel like I was a smart guy, a good guy, somebody who could execute things that maybe other kids my age might not. Whether that was true or not, it was a great source of self-esteem for me.
Yeah.
And then on the domestic side, you know, going to school, you know, the pros and the cons were, some of the pros were like maybe that girl that wouldn't talk to me before might talk to me now. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's still up to me to get a second conversation with her by not being boring. But, you know, the barrier to conversation was broken a bit.
Right.
But the jocks would pick on me a little bit more because there's this dude from TV that just showed up in February into our school year, and he's now talking to that girl that I was talking to 3 months ago when he was on the set. Where the hell did he come from? Right. So there was some animosity there, and but who didn't have a challenging time in junior high? So all of it was great and fine. Yes, it was challenging, many different moments in my career, and I'm sure is not over yet. You know, it's not a predictable way to earn a living, and I think that's part of the reason people are attracted to it. I certainly am.
I believe just before you would have graduated from high school, along comes Teen Wolf 2. This is the first movie. And then basically you've said that there was, I guess, after the cancellation of The Hogan Family, we're maybe looking at 1991-ish, something like that. Yeah. I guess you were 20 and things start to dry up a little bit.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like you ever stopped acting, but it just seems like the pace slowed.
Yeah, it went a little bit more into sort of working actor tempo, which, again, I looking back, was very, very fortunate that there was even that. Mm-hmm. But it was in comparison to what I had been sort of, you know, weaned on. I was the rat, you know, that was whatever they were putting in the water.
Right.
That's what I was drinking, you know, for 10 years and those are a very informative 10 years and you sort of try on a bunch of different suits to wear, and I'd picked one that needed the consistent employment and adulation and money and all that sort of junk food that I didn't know was junk food at the time. So there was a big adjustment during my 20s to kind of make a friend of reality and practicality and the unpredictability of the business. And that happened at the same time I was kind of catching up for lost time of being a kid, or I didn't really get to play a lot. And so I was doing all the things that a 20 to 30 year old does for playing at a time when I was also dealing with the frustration and the doubt and the insecurities of what not working in this business will bring. So that was a really challenging 10 years, not such that, you know, I don't want to paint a picture that things ever got dire, because there are some very legitimate cases of people, you know, finding themselves in a bad place. But
you could see how a person who had been a child star could go off the rails.
Without a doubt, yeah. It's a really, really difficult transition in the best of circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I would count myself as the best circumstance, whereby I was doing a pilot every year.
Right.
I mean, like, the carrot was right there and I got a nice big bite of it too. Like, I was getting paid to do these pilots, and the deals I was signing, you know, were go to series, like, they were looking good. So I had the opportunities to still kind of get that little boost where, boy, it's not over yet.
Right.
But it was still unnerving and frustrating and it was unsettling. I didn't know what the future was going to be. Was the rest of my career going to be anticlimactic? And the town was a Entertainment Tonight town. And and if you're not on that every few weeks, Jesus, what's wrong with you? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you go to a party you want to get invited to and people are saying, well, what have you been up to? And you keep saying nothing. And so it's a bit stifling here if you're not doing what you had been doing.
Right.
It's fine if you're still making a little bit of progress on trying to get there, but right. if you've come from a place of some kind of altitude
right.
and now you're constantly having to make excuses for, you know, what your plan is for the next ascent, it just gets a little exhausting, certainly for a kid that didn't really have the coping mechanism for that.
And you've said it was in those years, maybe, as would be the case with probably a lot of people at that age, but just booze and drugs and whatever. Now, with that, I wonder what came first, the chicken or the egg? Do you yeah. think that that was causing you to work less, or was that the result of you working less?
Yeah, that's a good question, and the fair answer is I'm not sure, but I will tell you that when I got sober, mm-hmm. things really took off. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't get so, and sober, I shouldn't use that word so freely. There are people that are militant about sobriety where they don't even use mouthwash. It's got alcohol in it. So I want to be fair. But when I stopped doing, you know, drugs and drinking, it was a year after we had been doing Arrested Development. So it wasn't like, you know, I stopped all that stuff and then I got arrested. I was doing Arrested, but Arrested had become something that I saw was providing me an opportunity to hit this reset button. Mm-hmm. And I've got some capital here that I don't want to misuse
yeah.
and disrespect. And I also met the woman that I'm still in love with and married to. And so the fact that I had a job to wake up for, a wife that had the clarity of not normalcy, because her dad is Paul Anka, and so she's certainly had a perspective on what this business is and what it can be. She just had a much more measured perspective, as you know, our better halves usually do. The combination of those two things was perfect.
Right.
I say that because I understand how some of my friends still to this day that I used to party with don't have that job to wake up for, mm-hmm. don't have that woman that they found, or whatever partner that they found that really kind of helps them see their best parts. If they don't have any reason to wake up at 7 a.m, then why not keep the party going all night? Because right. I can sleep all day tomorrow. Like, I get that, yeah. and I sympathize with that. So I was really lucky that I had some things to focus on that worked in concert with an instinct that I already had to start to slow things down, because I'd basically caught up all
right.
that sort of that hedonistic right. impulse and the catch up to playing. Basically, I'd leveled things out over those 10 years.
And you met your wife before the Arrested audition?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
well, no, before we were, or just?
Yeah, well before. In fact, I met her probably when I was 19 or 20.
Oh, wow.
But we started dating a few years before Arrested Development. I remember as things would start to come my way, certain projects that I would sort of scoff at still, because I was living in some sort of semi-diluted notion of who I was or what my position in the marketplace was. And of course, she had the perspective of like, no, you're not that great. She was like, no, you're reading for that.
Right.
And that turned into a couple of jobs that really were beneficial. I'm glad that she gave me that perspective.
So how did Arrested first cross your radar? And when it did, you know, did you immediately realize that it had the potential to be something special, or was it just to you another potential job at that point?
Working backwards, I did realize that it was something special because the single camera was just kind of coming into style, mm-hmm. and I certainly had a lot of multi-camera baggage on me. Multicam had become unfashionable, and I knew I was carrying a lot of that. And so I was surprised when they allowed me to come in and audition for this, because not only was it a single camera, but it was also kind of mockumentary.
Yeah.
And it had the pedigree of Imagine. It had Ron Howard narrating it. There was a piece of paper on the front of the script that said, anybody who is interested in sort of the fringes of a double banger or a triple banger or a pop-out trailer or all these sort of, you know, the things that fancy actors would want in their perk package, don't bother reading for this, because this is going to be this is going to be basically, it's going to be punk rock. Like mm-hmm. there's going to be no marks on the floor. There's going to be no lights. This is going to be news gathering basically. And we're not fucking around was the sort of the spirit of it, in not a shitty way, but just like, this isn't your dad's sitcom.
Right.
And so I thought, well, they're never going to see me for this. But I guess Mitch Hurwitz told me that I'd read for him for a multi-camera show, a pilot a few years earlier. And
did you remember this?
I didn't. Yeah. But he said that I did a really good audition. He didn't end up going with me. But he just remembered that I was good in the audition and thought that I'd be good for the part. So mm-hmm. he ended up seeing me for that. But the way the audition originally came my way was, I had been with Lee Brillstein at ICM for years and years and years, and we had some great success, but we had just parted ways about 3 months before this audition for no reason that she bears any blame for, but I just wanted to kind of shake things up. And she called me and she said, hey, I noticed that you're not on the sheet for this, that you haven't been seen for Arrested Development. And I don't know if your new agents are aware of it, but you should ask them to pursue it for you, because I think you'd be really great in that part. I mean, it was such a generous thing for her to do after we'd parted ways after so many years. And so I mentioned it to my agents. They mentioned this front sheet of this script and said, I don't know if it's going to be the right fit for you. Plus, Fox is never going to pick this thing up. If you want to read it, I'll send it to you. But it's going to be difficult. There's a comedic tone to this mm-hmm. thing that is not today. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, sounds pretty cool. Yeah. I'd love to. So I read it. Yes, please. I'd love to go and see if they'll see me. They said yes. I had scheduled for the following day another show that Mitch Hurwitz was producing, a more traditional multicam mm-hmm. show. And after the audition for him for Arrested Development, he followed me out of the room afterwards. And he said, hey, so listen, that was great. Good job. I said, thank you. Thanks. I really like it. He goes, yeah. He says, you're supposed to come in tomorrow for that other thing, right? And I said, yeah. He said, right. But this, right? I said, yeah. I love this show. He said, yeah. No, listen, don't come in for that thing tomorrow. And I was like, okay. He said, yeah. I said, I don't want the network to see you. I said, okay, I got you. I think this is good, right? He says, yeah, no, good. I said, okay, great. And he had to run back in to read somebody else. But I remember like flying down to my car and calling my agent and saying, I think I just got some good feedback from this thing. And
do you remember what the audition itself had entailed?
Well, it was certainly a scene from the pilot. Mm-hmm. I don't remember specifically which one it was, but I do remember just guessing what it is based on reading the whole script, what kind of lane my character, Michael Bluth, needed to fill in order to ground the incredibly eccentric, in a good way, the other characters were, and to try to provide some kind of a counterbalance to that. Yeah. And that was, you know, the genius of his construct.
You have said in another profile that I read, quote, with the characters that I'm really drawn to, I am the audience, close quote. And then separately, quote, I just don't want to be a character actor. I don't want to be the guy that explodes and does a bunch of acting. I like to be somebody who's a little bit more of a tour guide for the audience and observes those people that are doing a bunch of acting, close quote. Was that the case before Arrested Development, or was that as a result of finding a role that was essentially
No, no one's asked me that. You're right. It's Arrested. Mm-hmm. Arrested Development was my sense of humor at that time. Mm-hmm. I think earlier I was either by virtue of doing a lot of multicam, you know, studio audience stuff, I had really enjoyed developing this sort of, you know, performance style of comedy mm-hmm. as opposed to acting style of comedy. And I don't mean to be too cute with the terminology there, but for interest of, you know, being brief, but you know, when you're doing single camera comedy, you don't have to throw to the back row because the camera's right there. With multicam, because you're dealing with that proscenium and you are dealing with an audience, and in fact hearing a laugh track, there's either a conscious or subconscious kind of shared wink with the audience, and things are bigger. But my mother is British, and she was always very dry and sarcastic from that culture, and that really was my sense of humor underneath all of that stuff. And once Arrested Development happened, and specifically Jeffrey Tambor's mm-hmm. comedic tone and sensibility, once I saw that was what we were doing mm-hmm. and that it was okay to do that, basically do much, much less.
Right.
Think instead of act,
right.
Like the camera's close enough to see your wheels turning.
Right.
That was the level of specificity and subtlety that was really something that I was wanting to do and feeling like I could do at the time. And that runs kind of parallel to being the straight man,
right,
being the audience, being the person that is processing and perceiving the things that the audience is being shown. And it also runs in concert with my draw to be a director, you know, mm-hmm. the person whose job it is to shape an experience for an audience. And so what I was saying earlier about having two hands on the wheel, being the person in front of the camera, right, the actor, mm-hmm. and also a person behind the camera that's kind of holding the wheels, you're able to really hit a much narrower, finer, more specific target, which is that more subtle, more central character and work.
And so over the years since Arrested Development season one, we're now about to have season five, they have been intermittent, and in between there's been a lot of movies, and it seems like in many of those instances, and I'm going to bring up a few, and this is not in any way a critical observation, but just there's been a kind of a through line of people going to you for essentially a variation of the straight man, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I just wonder, I'm going to mention again, like I think The Switch, Horrible Bosses, Identity Thief, not The Change-Up, where I think because they're
that's kind of the one outlier.
And in a way, it's almost just seems to subvert that because you're the
but
guy.
But the way into that character was born from me starting as the normal guy who then pisses in a magic fountain and becomes a crazy guy. Like that was that was the way I could get there.
Right. So when you have people repeatedly coming to you to do a variation of this thing that you do very well, over those years, has that been gratifying or frustrating?
It was never frustrating. It's actually a large part my own doing. I mean, I turned down more opportunities to be sort of the antagonist as opposed to the protagonist, to oversimplify it, more opportunities than certainly my wife is comfortable with me doing. I mean, she wants to see me, you know, light my hair on fire, you know, get an accent and a limp and get on with it. But because of my creative, pardon the term, passion to do what it is I just described, which is kind of being that person that's kind of four-walling it for you, I've become much more cynical about the other, the quote acting, the morphing into a different person, the ask one makes to an audience to pretend that I'm not this guy, I'm actually that guy. And while I understand and respect the creative effort and challenge of that, and I don't take anything away from actors that really get off on that, I spent a lot of years with that. In fact, I thought I, you know, the goal was to be Lon Chaney Jr.
Right.
Like, you know, and then it was like, well, all right, then I guess I'll just be Robert De Niro or Dustin Hoffman or Al Pacino. Like that was a concession to be those guys. And then ultimately, you know, as I got older and less, you know, less 11 years old and 12 years old, I sort of discovered who I was just as a person, and then ultimately discovered what I want to be creatively and professionally. And it's become this. So again, I don't take anything away from actors that like acting, but I am really attracted to something different. And I use that lane, that job, that role of acting to help facilitate that, which is to, again, pardon the phrase, but shape that experience for the audience. And being the person that you most relate to affords me a bigger lever to pull for that.
And it is amazing how much you can communicate and connect and sort of resonate with an audience by doing relatively little in the sense of not being a showy, you know, capital A actor. And to that point, I don't know if you've ever come across this, but when I was prepping, I came across a website that is devoted to, quote, the JBF, close quote. Have you heard about this?
No.
The JBF is the Jason Bateman face, as in the face that you make when you're processing stupidity that cracks people up, and they literally have made GIFs of you doing this.
So this is me listening to somebody be an idiot?
Yes.
Got
and
it.
So they have figured out the commonalities in this, and they...
Oh, they've broken it.
They've broken it down.
There's an equation.
I'm going to give it to you.
There's probably a blink in it.
Adopting a slower-than-normal blink. Holding your eyebrows up a little higher than usual. Closing your mouth firmly, pausing before saying anything. And it was great because they actually have the visual evidence. And I thought it's in a way is a microcosm of what we're talking about, where, you know, that is probably a physical manifestation of what anyone else is thinking when they're seeing the insanity around your characters.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And look, it's something that It's not the flashier part ever. I mean, that character, that role gets his or her laughs.
Yeah.
But it's not the person you're shelling out your money to go see. Like, you know, I mean, I'm not being overly humble here. Who's going to go see a Jason Bateman vehicle? You know, you go see a Will Ferrell vehicle, and I would die to play Will Ferrell's straight man.
Right.
Now, Will Ferrell will still sell tons of tickets and be incredibly funny without a straight man. But with one, it just allows kind of the, I'm going to make myself sick with these analogies, but the clap becomes louder because you've got two hands there as opposed to just, you know, waving around one crazy hand that can get you your laughs. But you, it is a two-part equation, and the straight man is kind of hard to find because not a lot of people want to do it, or they might press because they want seven laughs instead of three.
Well, it was always Dean grading against Jerry, right?
Yeah.
That was the whole, I think that ended up causing friction in their relationship. But anyway, it's so interesting that you've thought about it as much as, like, in this kind of, well, you know, thought through way. And I wonder though, how does it affect improv? I think improv was a big part of Arrested Development, right? Do you just by being the character for a while and kind of you can stay within the character and still be the like, it's a complicated way of just saying, like, how much improv was actually a part of Arrested Development?
Not a lot. And the writing is everything it's got its reputation to be. It's very well earned. I mean, those scripts are incredibly well written and need no plussing from us dingbats. Having said that, the style of the show is very kind of deconstructed. It is news gathering. It is a documentary, or it was supposed to be sort of in its original format. So one is supposed to be finding your thoughts and overlapping, and it's supposed to be messy. And if somebody makes an entrance, the camera then finds them, as opposed to the camera being ready for that entrance. And so there is inherent in there a messiness that going off of script can help facilitate. So there's plenty of messing up the front and the back of lines, and then certainly once you've got the first few takes done as written, then inevitably, you know, we'll end up being idiots. Not a lot of that usually outdoes what's written.
And as somebody who had come of age in multicam, was it an adjustment to not have an audience laughing when you tell a joke, or being a part of a joke, or something crazy happens, and just to not even have the continuity that you would have with multicam? Was that a jarring thing?
It wasn't a jarring thing. It was just a completely different thing. And as I said, something that I was really excited by, which was there's a laugh that you can get when there's no audience there, but there's a camera there, by not winking. It's a quiet thing. It's a shared thing with an audience member that you don't see, you don't hear, and you're never going to meet. It's a real sort of private kind of line of communication that you have through that camera into that TV onto that person on the couch. There's anonymity to it. There's more anonymity. Whereas with the studio audience, it is not only implied, but it's there. I mean, you have to hold till they're done laughing. So there's an extra energy that they bring that you need to infuse your performance with. And it's a different thing. It's a different thing to write. It's a different thing to perform. And it's really exciting. I still think that an actor on a multicam sitcom is the best job in the business for many, many reasons. But my style of humor, I think, is better suited for single cam at this moment. But maybe I would. I haven't done any studio audience comedy for I don't know how long, and it would probably be like visiting an old friend again and want to hang out a bunch.
And you'd be open to that.
Yeah. In fact, Jimmy Burrows called me to do a little something on this new incarnation of Will and Grace a few months back, and I couldn't think. I was in Atlanta doing Ozark, but God, the 12 hours it took me to kind of check the schedule and see if there could be, I mean, I wore it. I mean, I tried it on and I was going to do it in my mind, and just got really giddy about just the idea of not only, you know, doing that job in front of an audience again, but specifically with those people too. It would have been a real privilege.
To put a button on the Arrested stuff, I just want to ask you, the show was and, you know, remains beloved by critics and the TV community, won Best Comedy Series Emmy in 2004, was nominated several other times. You got a Golden Globe for the first season. The people that watched it loved it, but it could never get massive numbers. And you guys, I think, every year lived in fear that this is not coming back the next year, right?
Yeah.
So what was that about? Why is that?
I mean, I don't know. I think smarter people would probably give you a more accurate answer. But my instinctual answer is that it was on a broadcast network at the time when broadcast networks were still the dominant vehicle by which you got your television. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, your audience was populated by a larger number. Your obligation being on a network show was to provide a populist piece of entertainment. Mm-hmm. There was a specificity to what Mitch did with the writing that was counter to a populist delivery, mm-hmm. you know? And I think we probably got the number that was right for the show. And I'll bet you that the number is the same on Netflix. Mm-hmm. I don't think that show has the necessary rounded corners mm-hmm. that lends itself to populist numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, Fox, rightly so, you know, they're selling ads based on how many eyeballs they get. And if they're only going to get 4 million people for this, but 8 million people for that, well, we're going to put the 8 million people show on so we can get double our ad rates. I mean, I get it. I don't think it had anything to do with more than that.
And when Fox pulled the plug after all these years of wondering if that was going to happen, did you ever imagine that it would be revived at anywhere else, let alone Netflix?
Yeah. Immediately there was a conversation with, I don't think I'm making any news here. I think it was known at the time mm-hmm. that we were talking with Showtime, mm-hmm. but that there were some mechanics in the deal that I wasn't privy to that mm-hmm. it didn't make any sense there. And then a few years later, it happened at Netflix, but the network or channel landscape was starting to become fractured enough where I thought it was probably pretty reasonable that there would be a station that their goal is only to get that 3 or 4 million, yeah. you know, person audience,
right.
and that's plenty, and that it would make sense. I wouldn't know what the license fee would be on something like that, and would that be able to accommodate the cast salaries or the production mm-hmm. budget? But that wasn't for me to figure out, and yeah. all I knew is that I loved doing it and loved yeah. all those people and was an eager participant, right. you know, listening to all the conversations about it.
When you were starting out, film was considered the place you wanted to be. That was, the kind mm-hmm. of ultimate place you could end up. Now I think it's kind of flipped to TV is the coolest place to be in a way. But as that was changing, you were doing a little bit of both. And I just wonder, I wanted to ask you about the Reitman movies there, Juno and Up in the Air. I think Juno is one of the best movies of this century, and you were great in it. And it's actually different than a lot of these other parts, I think, that we've talked about in the type of straight man versus others. It's very different. And same also with another one that I think did not get the appreciation that I remember it feeling it deserved. I don't think it got a big release, but Disconnect, that was very different than any of the things we've talked about. Do you approach picking roles in film any differently than TV? We've talked a little bit about just the commonalities, but like, how does a Juno enter the picture?
That was something that I recognized throwing you a lot of shitty terms, but no. the texture and the nuance in that script and in that project, certainly the way that he was talking about doing it, certainly I would love to be a part of. I mean, it's, you know, we all have that inside of us. We're sometimes paid and asked to do other things mm-hmm. that might be less complicated, but sure, I'd love to play that part. I'd love to be a part of a film that is striving to succeed on multiple areas. And so that was fantastic to be a part of that. I don't think any of us saw the kind of reception that was going to get.
Which includes, I mean, and you've talked about this in other interviews, I saw a Best Picture nomination. You've been in movies that made 8-9 figure, you know, profits mm-hmm. here, but this, maybe it wasn't commercially, it did very well commercially, it's not of that level, but to be in a Best Picture Oscar nominee probably has
crazy.
An effect, right?
Yeah, that was a real mind blower to go to the Oscars.
Yeah.
Was, you know, sitting down there in the pit and, you know, meeting and staring at and shaking hands with some people that I just never really thought I'd ever get the chance to do that with. Mm-hmm. So that was certainly fun. And then, you know, the other roles, the other parts that are, you know, slightly more dramatic or kind of melancholy, you know, that's, like I said, we all have that, mm-hmm. where everybody kind of wakes up quiet and goes to bed quiet. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a part of everybody. And I love acting in those parts. I really love directing those kinds mm-hmm. of movies. There's a commercial ceiling on those mm-hmm. on those things, and that's unfortunate, but I get it. I think it's one of the really exciting things about what Netflix provides, or some of the other companies that are going to be making some movies for streaming, you know, where they don't have to make that $30 million spend to create a profile and a social pressure to go mm-hmm. see something by virtue of the saturation and the marketing. You know, you just make like a really good movie for $5, $10, $15 million and mm-hmm. you put it up on the site and you market it towards the people that are predisposed to enjoy yeah. something like that, and it succeeds on its merits.
Right.
So I look forward to acting in more of those movies mm-hmm. and making those movies. But there's another part of my business that is more commercial and yeah. more comedic and more studio, and I really enjoy doing those yeah. too. They're sneaky tough to do well, and I respect the kind of exposure that the studios take on financially to do those, because there is that other marketing component that they are obligated to do yeah. that just demands that the movie really performs mm-hmm. to just hit middle.
Yeah.
And that's tough today, because as you said, television is doing a lot of things well, and the burden to cross to ask them, somebody to leave their house is pretty high.
Yeah. All right. So for the home stretch here, all Ozark, I got to ask you, just the thing that most appealed to you initially was the idea that, I mean, A, how did it cross your radar, but B, it sounds like the thing that most appealed to you was that you can come in here and direct kind of as much as you want, right?
Yeah, it was great. I'll do it, but only if I can direct all the mm-hmm. episodes and see if they're open to that. I'm sure they're not, and mm-hmm. I'll get out of their way. But just know that, you know, we're really enjoying pursuing a third film for me to direct, and mm-hmm. I want that to be something that really challenges me and mm-hmm. makes me scared, and some sort of an escalation in tone, responsibility, and scope. And I was like, well, Jesus, you know, directing a 600-page movie would certainly qualify in all of those things. Yeah. And so tell them I'd love to talk to them about doing that if mm-hmm. they're open to it. And you know, they said, no, yeah, well, listen, we appreciate your interest as an actor, but we are actually at the director stage, and we are looking at, you know, I won't tell you the names, mm-hmm. but, you know, probably two or three of from the top five on the feature directing list. Wow. And I was like, oh, got it. I'll wait my turn. And to my agent's credit, Michael Cooper, he was like, well, no, hang on. Let me go talk to Modi Wichick over at MRC and let him know what your hope is. Mm-hmm. And basically, as I can surmise from what you said to me, Jason, what your idea and your vision for it is. Mm-hmm. And made an incredible pitch, I guess, to Modi. And Modi said, great, I'll sit down with them. And so Modi came over and sat down with me, and I basically gave him my pitch. And he said, okay. And off we went, and we pitched Netflix, and Ted and Cindy said yes. And then as we got into budgeting and scheduling, I just could not create enough time to prep all 10 episodes. Yeah. It would have been about a 40-week prep. Would have probably been a 20-month post, and it just wasn't tenable. So I, heartbroken, said, well, I'll do the first two and the last two. Mm-hmm. But as EP on it, I was afforded the same, not the same, but a similar level of oversight that I was looking to challenge myself with. And that's been really, really rewarding. And
well,
really,
and the aesthetic is really, that runs even through the episodes that you did not direct. You set it for the whole series. So I know there were a few references in particular that were, I think, mainly cinematic, but that were important for this, right?
Yeah, I'm a big David Fincher fan, and I'm a big fan of, you know, I think Scott Cooper does really, really good work with a lot of stuff, but specifically I was focusing on Out of the Furnace. There was a tamped down kind of raw, unsettling environment that he was able to create and maintain throughout that. I mean, the things that he lets actors not do, mm-hmm. lets production designers not do, I think shows a lot of discipline and taste, and Fincher the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a visual component and a musical component, or in this case, sonic component, that I think sets the table better for an audience to receive the great work that the writers do on this mm-hmm. show and in other things that I think are of similar tone. So, you know, there's cinematographers that sort of speak to that as well. Adam Arkapaw, I really like a lot, and certainly like Top of the Lake mm-hmm. was a big influence for me for this show. And in fact, Peter Mullen was the first person I wanted to cast in the show from his work in that. And there's that palette and that sort of atmosphere and environment that you want to create visually yeah. and that hopefully you can maintain as the EP on the show, as you hire the other directors, as you have these tone meetings with these directors and production meetings with all the department heads and try to make it a 10-chapter movie as opposed to mm-hmm. 10 different episodes.
Right.
And in the writer's room as well, you know, that was the mandate. Like, let's make a 600-page movie. And, mm-hmm. and if that means episodes 2 through 3 are going to be 2 and 3 are slow because we're setting up, you know, the second act, well, then so be it. And
right.
we just have to make the assumption and cross our fingers that people are going to bite off 3 and 4 hour chunks
right.
of this thing and we'll appreciate that.
And then from the acting side of this, have you done anything you think that was as emotionally demanding from you personally? I thought that it was interesting. I loved a comment you made to somebody else that, quote, if Tom Hanks had done Philadelphia right off of Bosom Buddies, he would have been laughed at. But essentially, you know, to consolidate the rest of the quote, you've been moving towards this. It's not like it's out of the blue, but it seems like with some of the very emotional stuff that you're called upon to do here, it feels like it is the Philadelphia in that progression, right?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'd let smarter people like you speak to the strategy of it all, but I was not ashamed or embarrassed or nervous about the audience receiving me or accepting me in this part, if for no other reason than what we were talking about before, which is that sort of the middleman that I always play, you know, whether it's a comedy or a drama, I'm usually the guy that's pretty close to the median. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in a comedy, I'm the guy reacting to somebody crazy. And in the drama, I'm the guy reacting to the person with the gun. So this is a character that occupies that space. He's somebody who is sort of a normal guy that's trying to provide for his family and sort of gets a little lazy with his ethics and his work habits or whatever it is and decides to cut a corner. And we get to watch him try to navigate how all that went sideways. And that leaves open moments of loss of dignity and confusion and also humor, because a person is put into a corner and you're reacting from a very human and, yes, audience-centric position. You know, how would you, the person sitting at home watching this, react? And that's the part I've always asked the audience to accept me as, and that part of it felt consistent.
I'm glad you've pushed back against what I think is the lazy comparison to just everybody wants to bring up Breaking Bad, which is they're both really good shows,
yeah.
and they happen to have, you know, middle-aged guys that kind of cause themselves to fall into,
yeah.
you know, problems, but it's very different.
Yeah, but that trope has been around forever.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
You're always trying to put at the center somebody the audience can relate to,
mm-hmm.
and then put them in a circumstance that is as eccentric or extraordinary as possible so that the audience doesn't feel like they've wasted their money. Well, shit, that happens to me every day.
Right.
You know, there's going to be a blowback from that. You need to create a wild situation, but hopefully the person going through it is somebody the audience can relate to. So I think that's very similar in Breaking Bad and Ozark and any other show that's
well,
out
Walter
there.
Walter comes to like being the
right.
criminal.
That's a territory we will not get into if for no other reason than out of respect to that show
yeah.
and probably for a more sane reason, which is that they've already done that and they
yeah.
did a great job of that and we don't want to be redundant. You know, there's also the comparison, whether people are aware of it or not, sometimes I forget about it, but that Brian and I also come from television comedy you know,
yeah.
specifically Fox. I mean, Malcolm in the Middle was on when Arrested Development was on.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
maybe people are channeling that as well. I don't know. But
yeah.
listen, any comparison to that show, to him, is incredibly kind.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are half as good and half as successful as they
yeah.
are, good God, we would be thrilled.
And then just to close, this is a rapid fire. First thing that comes to your mind, 3 things. There was always talk of an Arrested Development movie. Do you imagine that this is ever actually going to happen?
I don't. And for a, you know, I'll spare you the longer, more business-centric answer to that, but we've covered a lot of it here. Yeah. I think just the mechanics of business today, that, you know, what you've got to bring to sell tickets at a box office is something that I don't think Arrested Development occupies, and mm-hmm. I think it's at its perfect place,
right.
That being Netflix, where, you know, they're making movies and TV shows, and we're kind of doing a bit of both of that with this.
This next one is, you know, not the most comfortable to bring up, but you guys are about to go out with the fifth season, and we just had a big article that Jeffrey participated in, mm-hmm. Jeffrey Tambor, in The Hollywood Reporter with my colleague Seth Abramovich. He's obviously dealing with some difficult times at the moment. It seems like even amongst the Arrested family, there's some trepidation about how do you navigate this. There were quotes from folks in that. It's a weird time for anyone in Hollywood right now. Yeah. What's the way forward here?
With respect to?
With Jeffrey, because he's in this season, right? The fifth season.
Oh, we were done with the season before of this came around, yeah.
I mean, it just seems a tough position for everybody.
For sure. I mean, it's complicated for sure when anybody, and it happens almost constantly, where somebody finishes a project and then between the time that principal photography wraps and the film comes out, something has gone on in their personal life that they have to address when it comes time to promote and market. Look, what Jeffrey is dealing with and what went on is something that I have no idea about. Mm-hmm. That is something that only he and the people who he is dealing with on that know about. Mm-hmm. That is a transparent situation. All I know is Jeffrey from Arrested Development.
Right.
I have no idea about anything else in his life.
Right.
All I can say is that my time with him has always been some of my favorite time in my life, and I love him deeply.
Yeah.
I empathize with what he is going through, what the people on the other side of it are going through. It sounds like a really challenging situation for all parties with that, and I wish them all well with it wherever it goes from here.
Right. And the final one is just, you know, we've now gone back over a lot of your life and career, and I just wonder if it's the way you've described Arrested Development entering the picture in 2003 or whatever, was that it was really a turning point. And so what I want to ask you is, had it not come along, what do you imagine you would be doing today? It could be this is the art version of the change up.
You know, I was really close to literally liquidating what little I had left, putting that cash in a duffel bag and going down to the Tom Bradley terminal and
Seriously?
Looking up at the ticker board. Yeah. Like that last scene in Up in the Air, where he's looking
right.
up at the destination board.
But you're not speaking hyperbolically.
I really fantasized about that, because remember what I was saying about, like, this town isn't, it's an industry town. And unless you're comfortable with your standing in it or the direction your arrow may or may not be pointing, it's a tough place to be. And so I thought, well, I'm so young, I can just unplug and go plug in somewhere else. Didn't have a wife, didn't have kids, mm-hmm. you know, didn't have a career,
right.
you know, had a few friends, but, you know, they can come visit me or I can come back and visit them. So it was like, it was kind of that romantic kind of what a kid deals with when they finish college. It's like,
right.
well, I can go start life anywhere.
Right.
And so I thought, well, why don't I go do that? Then I started to observe Jimmy Burrows as a director doing multi-camera. I was like, well, why don't I continue pursuing that? What we were talking about with Hogan Family back at 18.
Where did you observe him?
Just directing different episodes. You know, I mean, Jimmy was directing everything. And I kind of became a little bit of his apprentice. He had a few of them. I mean, everybody wanted to follow mm-hmm. Jimmy. And his agent at the time, Bob Broder, took me on and gave me to Ted Chervin, who was under him. And I was starting to get some nibbles as a director in multicam. And so I bet you I would have gone that direction and become a multicam director, you know, if they would have had me. Now, as we all know, that dried up a bit. Maybe I would still be working, God bless them, over at Nickelodeon and the Disney Channel, where they're making, you know, great multicam shows that, thank God, are still employing a lot of the great writers and producers that we have from our multicam days in the 80s and 90s. But maybe I'd be doing that, or maybe I would have gotten a different Arrested mm-hmm. Development, because there's a lot of really talented actors, writers, directors that are still just one job away. It
right.
really is just one job. And if it is received and embraced by the people in this town, you'll do great. You know, what are the numbers on Mad Men, mm-hmm. you know, or even Sopranos, you know, like, I think Mad Men, like, 3 million people would watch that show, and like that's. But the people in LA were watching that show. Right. People across the country weren't necessarily. Right. Even Sopranos, maybe it was 8 million or something like that. Like those aren't network numbers, but LA and New York watched that show, and consequently, the people on that show, on those shows, and I could probably list a million more, ended up having really nice careers. And so Arrested Development was that for me, and maybe it would have been something else, and, right. and I would have gotten another reset button. But I'm forever thankful that it was Arrested Development and that things continue to be fortunate for me, as I knock on wood.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg, and you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.